All right. Thank you, Billy. My name is Doug Rowland. I am a grateful alcoholic. Grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Grateful to be an alcoholic. And I something's wrong with my voice. Not quite working quite right. And I totally lost my singing voice. It's all gone forever. And there was some that said it wasn't that much to lose. So far, I've been able to talk most of the time, but I don't know. My doctor's sending me to get lung and a heart test and all kinds of throat tests, and I can't find anything wrong. I think, you know, I've heard old men talk like this. Maybe it's just the way old men talk. Maybe that's what happens when you get old. So anyway, but so I can still talk, and I want to thank Billy for inviting me to come and do this. I like doing this. I know some AA speakers that are great speakers. I mean, they could talk behind a podium and nobody would drink for 30 miles around, you know. I mean, they're just so spiritual, but they really don't like doing it. And but they do it, of course, because it's an AA commitment. And they get all silly and nervous about it. I'm just the opposite. I don't know if I'm a good speaker or not, and I really couldn't care less. Billy invited me to do it. Hey, I'm happy to do it. I like doing it. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to, you know? But they didn't ask me. I was a little drunk that night, but I would have got up there and said something in much better voice than that I got today. But anyway, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. It's nice. I saw my wife join me here. Some of you know Carla. And I see Al. Al and I used to have the same sponsor, Dick Martin. And Carla and I have heard each other speak so much that if I actually do lose my voice, she can step right in and finish the talk. In fact, we're doing a lot of these Zoom talks, and most of the times we don't even go and hear each other. We get irritated if we can hear it from the other room. Pardon me, but anyway, I said, I don't come from an alcoholic family. I didn't start drinking too young. I was 18 when I had my first drink, and that was only because my friend Morris said, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you got to get her drunk. So I wasn't interested in drinking, but I was interested in that home run thing. And so I stole a quart of Rainier Ale, and we went and parked by the railroad tracks. And we had parked by the railroad tracks before, but now I got my ammunition. And so I cracked the top on that bottle and had a little pull on it. You know, I've heard a lot of alcoholics say, man, when that first swallow of alcohol passed my lips, I was home. The angel sank. That was not my story. Rainier Ale to me tasted, the first time I tasted it at 18 years old, tasted like carbonated dishwater. And but I wasn't there for the taste anyway. So I drank some and handed it to her. And she drank some and passed it back. And we killed that bottle in about 5 minutes. And it turned out this was the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz. And the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. So, I'm going to do both of these things much as I can the rest of my life. You know, we talk about commitments in AA. That was a commitment, and I kept it as good as I could. And I thought I didn't start too young. You know, I was virtually a man. I was draftable age by the time I had my first drink. I didn't come from an alcohol family. My dad enjoyed a beer, and he said, you know, I enjoy a beer. I enjoy a beer once in a while, and he really did. But when he said he enjoyed a beer, he meant he enjoyed a beer. You know, like he would be out working in the yard or working on his car or watching a football game and stop and have a beer and then go back to what he was doing, which I've known people that drank like that. And it always amuses me because if I stop and have a beer, that is now what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. And whatever I was doing before couldn't have been very important, or why would I stop and have a beer, huh? Okay, so my mother may have been an alcoholic. We never could tell. You can't tell if they won't drink, and she wouldn't drink. I dare you to diagnose a case of alcoholism beside somebody that won't swallow any alcohol. So I asked her one time, why don't you drink? And she said, why do you want to know? I said, are you an alcoholic? She said, really? Am I an alcoholic? Have you ever seen me take a drink in your life? I said, no, but I know hundreds of alcoholics that don't drink. What's your deal? And she said, why do you want to know this? See, and that sounds evasive to me. So I said, okay, I was hoping to spare you this, Mom, but the fact is there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. So it may be your fault I'm a drunk. What do you think about that? And she said, I'll tell you, when I think about that, I think it's funny. She said, I don't know. When I was young and my friends drank, I drank with them. But every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I stopped. And I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know, the promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. You just don't, you know, puke on somebody's shoes and go, oh, I got to quit. You know, you're never going to make it to the rooms, Mom. She didn't have the tenacity that it takes to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know. I had three younger sisters. None of them were alcoholics as far as I could tell. No reason to think they were. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I think I'm like a self-made alcoholic. I had a little bit of a music career, and then I got out of that and I started working as a prop man in TV in LA, because people in LA talk about the business. They're talking about show business, movies and TV primarily, you know. And it depends on what city you're in. If you're in Maine, the business is probably lobsters. I don't know, you know. If you're in Washington D.C., the business is politics. But in Southern California and Hollywood, the business is the business, man. It's like, and so I got most everybody, about 40% of the people in L.A. work in the business, and everybody else works in stores and car lots and things that support them, and people who work for the city, et cetera. Anyway, but I got working in TV, and I started out with a pretty good reputation because I was young and strong and smart, and I could pay attention, and I had a little bit of theater background. But the more I drank and used, the more my reputation started to take a hit. And I had a couple of friends that had gone to AA, one of them in particular. My friend Teddy was my drinking partner. You know, I loved to drink with Teddy. She was just this crazy woman. She would do anything, especially when she was drinking. And she was drinking most of the time, drinking and using, you know. I might as well tell you right off the bat, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program that saved my life, but I'm also a drug addict. They're separate things, but they seem to come together for me. And, if I had known, I didn't know, you know, I mean, I only used like every drug I ever heard of. But if I had known, you know, back in the day that there might be a separation sometime, if somebody said to me, hey, man, try this, I would have said, oh, you know what, I'd love to, but I'm going to be speaking in an AA meeting 30 years from now, and I don't want to piss anybody off. So anyway, me and Teddy would go out, man, and she called me up and said, what are you doing? And I ain't got no plans. My next absolute is Thursday. She'd say, let's go get drunk and be somebody. Man, I'd fire up that Harley, go pick up Teddy, and we would go get in trouble, you know. We were just born for trouble. And she was just a lot of fun to be with. But you know, if you go drinking with Teddy, there's a good chance you're going to get in a fight because the girl had a mouth on her, and or end up in handcuffs. I mean, that happened about, I don't know, maybe 30% of the time. But it was worth it because she was just so much fun. But what happened was Teddy went to AA, and Teddy was with me when I skied off a cliff up at Mammoth Mountains, skied off a 50-foot cliff. And it wasn't an accident either. I thought I could do it. It was shortly after the Winter Olympics. And I don't know, you know, the way I get on a ski lift and I want to take my gloves off and reach over here and get my vial of cocaine and do a little one-in-one wake up and then reach over here, get my little flask and have a shot of whiskey, put all that away, get out my windlass pipe, enjoy the scenery all the way up to the top, you know, get off, grab that boater bag, have a shot of white wine, and then ski down the hill. And to be honest, that might be a good idea on the first run, you know, to loosen up kind of. But if you do that every run for 20 or 30 runs, by 3:30, when the shadows are getting long and the snow is icing over and you're no kind of condition to be involved in an athletic event, that's when I decided it'd be a good idea to ski off of a 50-foot cliff. And and you know, those Winter Olympic guys, as soon as they're airborne, they lean over the front of their skis. I thought they did it because it looks cool, because it does. It looks very cool. Turns out if you don't do that cool-looking lean over the skis thing, your skis somehow will go straight up in the air. And then your head is on the bottom, and you're heading towards the planet. Skis on top, head on the bottom, which is never recommended. You'll never find an article in Ski Magazine about how to unweight in the air by putting your skis on top and your head on the bottom. It's just not recommended. None of the good people do that. But I did, and I landed. Fortunately, my arm hit first, and it broke my shoulder. And Teddy and the ski patrol had to bring me down to the bottom, and Teddy had to drive my van back home. And I went in the hospital, and they operated on my shoulder, and I'm out of work for 6 weeks. And then after I got back to work, Teddy and I went to a party, and it was like a Friday night party that lasted all night long. And in the morning, most of the people were gone, but the woman that owned the house said, somebody go get some eggs, make some breakfast for everybody. So me and Teddy jumped on the scooter and started to go get eggs. I don't know why I thought Harley's and eggs was a good combination, but we're off to go get eggs. And just as we fired up that scooter, the sun hit the horizon. You know how when it's nighttime and the sky is black and all of a sudden there's like a light across the horizon and the sky starts turning to a light blue and it's really a sexy look. And it was April, so it's not hot, it's not cold. Southern California is brisk in April. And so we had that brisk air flying in our hair and the Harley rumble and the sunrise. Everything about it was so sexy. We thought we should make love in the great outdoors. And I don't know if you're familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's not a place where they have a lot of great outdoor lovemaking venues. I don't know, maybe the Burbank City Council took a vote and said, no, we don't need any outdoor lovemaking venues. Let the public find their own. So we found a 4-story parking structure, which we figured worked just fine. But the gate was locked. So we went around to the fire escape, parked the bike, ran up the fire escape, and we're going to have our way in this open air top of this 4-story parking structure, except the door was locked. And I figured a 4-story fire escape door is open from the inside. So I jumped over the wall and land inside and open the door. That was my plan. I made the jump, but I didn't get the part about getting over the wall. Evidently, I wasn't as agile as I thought I was that night. Probably because I had a 0.40 blood alcohol level, which... The reason I know that is because this was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. And so when I fell off that 54-foot building, and landed feet first, and my knees buckled, and I kicked myself in the ass and broke my pelvis in two places, broke the heel bone off my right foot, shoved it to my foot like a bowling ball, and broke all those little bones in your foot, you know. I didn't walk away from that one, but here I am in the hospital parking lot. So Teddy Wren's back in the hospital, and she comes out. She tells him, my friend just fell off your parking lot, and it broke him. He's easy to find. He's crumpled up by the fire escape there. So they ran out and got me, and they brought me in the hospital, and I was in that hospital for 10 days while they tried to figure out how to put my foot back together. And friends were coming in and bringing me gifts, you know. and it never occurred to me to say to the doctors, I know you're giving me Demerol and Percodan for the pain, because I was in a lot of pain. I'm self-administering cocaine and Irish whiskey. Is that going to be a conflict? And I guess it wasn't, because it never became a problem. And it didn't occur to me to mention it to the doctors, because, you know, what the hell? If something happened, I'm in the hospital. It's not like they got to come find me somewhere. Anyway, when I got out of there, it took me 5 months before I could walk without a crutch or a cane or something. I had to, I was in surgery for 8 hours while they made my foot look like a foot again. And I couldn't put any weight on it for 8 months. I mean, 5 months. But what happened was Teddy got sober right after that. Like, I always thought it was weird that I fall off a building and she hits bottom. But everybody who loved Teddy was thrilled about it, because we knew she was going to die if she kept drinking and using. She was just that crazy. And so we were happy about her. And what happened was a miracle. She turned from this crazy, loudmouth, drunken woman to a lady in every sense of the word in 2 weeks. I mean, it was amazing. Everybody thought that was a good thing, except if you talk to her, she's always going to throw in things like meetings, blah, 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 big book. Man, my sponsor says, blah, blah, blah. When I took the steps, you know, finally I told her, Ted, shut up. Okay. Just shut up. Look, I don't know if you're trying to draft me into your deal or what, but I'll tell you this. If I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA. And she said, what? Oh, my God, Doug. What would you call interference? Brain death? And I said, okay, I see where you're going with this. But I don't think that accidents should count, really. I mean, anybody fall off a four-story building, drunk or sober, is going to get hurt, bad hurt. In fact, I might have died if I hadn't been drunk. So, you know, you're getting alcoholism mixed up with gravity. And she said, okay, I'm out of here. And she walked away. She left the room, and I thought, good, I won. But all that week, every time I had a little quiet moment, I would picture Teddy's face saying, what would you call interference, Doug? Brain death? And I started thinking about it. You know, all those two accidents I just told you about could have easily ended in brain death if I had landed differently. There were three other bad accidents that could have landed in brain death if I landed differently. And the next one very well may. I got no control over that. And there will be a next one if I keep drinking. If I keep drinking, I might end up in a wheelchair or in bed, unable to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself and know it. And that's a scary thought. That's about as scary a thought as I can think of today. So I rush right down to AA 3 years later, because, you know, you gotta think about it. I mean, I'm compulsive about some things, admittedly, but recovery, you know, you really don't want to jump into it. And in fact, when I went to my first meeting, I did not go to get sober. I didn't go to stop drinking. I went to see I'd heard about the 12 steps. I didn't know what they were, but maybe one or two or three of these 12 steps I can apply to my seriously cutting down, because I knew I drank too much. Apply them to my seriously cutting down, and then I can have a cold beer on a hot day. That's what people do. Or a little wine with dinner, you know. I'll have the a 12-ounce porterhouse, please, medium rare, and a nice dry red with that. Maybe a Beaujolais or a Pinot Noir. You know what sounds good? Petit Sirah. What year petites do you have, young man? You know what I'm saying? Responsible adult beverage consumption. A little sake with my sushi. A little margarita with my enchilada. Yeah, or sometimes get a fifth of whiskey and chug it down and have an inappropriate experience. But just not all the time. And that I was having more inappropriate experiences than appropriate ones. So I thought, I better go check out AA. So I went, they had a big speaker meeting. Somebody told me, if you want to check out AA, go to a big speaker meeting. They'll leave you alone. That's a lie. We don't stay sober leaving new people alone. That's not how it's done here. But I guess they meant, you know, I wouldn't be asked to speak or something. But anyway, they told me go to a big speaker meeting. So there was a big speaker meeting I heard about Friday night in Van Nuys at the Valley Presbyterian Hospital. They had a subterranean community room that they rented out, the big room with a stage. And I went there early and I saw people setting up chairs and making coffee and setting up literature and hanging signs and hugging and laughing. And I thought, oh man, this is like a damn Boy Scouts or something, you know? And so I'm looking irritated and I lean against the wall over by the double doors, looking as irritated as I could so nobody would talk to me. And because people people don't want to talk to somebody looking irritated, but that didn't keep the AAs away. They'd come up, you're new, right? And I'd say, wrong. Walk away. And so most people did, except this one guy, Hank, he comes up and he goes, you're new. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, oh, I haven't seen you here before. What's your name? And I said, my name is Doug. And you haven't seen me here before because I've never been here before. So mystery solved, take a hike, pal. And he said, oh, well, that's what we mean by new, man. You've never been here before. That's new to us, right? Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm new. I'm new like I'd never been here before, but I'm not new like a new member. I don't know what it looks like out there, but I'm not in here going, help me, I'm drowning in a sea of alcohol. No, that's not what's going on here, man. I'm here, observing, I'm visiting, okay? I'm auditing the class. I'm not a joiner, man. I never have been. I never have been. I'm a loner. I'm an outlaw, okay? A desperado, you know, a misfit. I'm a misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I don't really fit in the workplace. I barely fit in my own damn family. So I'm pretty sure I'm not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. Hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? Let's set up some chairs. I'm sorry. Kill me now, brother, because I'm just here looking to see what you guys are doing. I won't bother anybody. Please, nobody bother me, okay? You got that? And you know what he said? Man, I like you. You're going to fit right in. Jesus, could I have been any more articulate about how I'm not going to fit in? But, of course, he was right. I mean, if some new person said to me what I just told you I said to him, I'd say, oh, yeah, yeah, you're going to fit. Come on in, man. Ooga booga, one of us, brother. You got a big book? You want some coffee? You know, but I didn't understand any of that. And this other guy comes in. There's another guy. I'm leaning against the wall by the double doors, and people are starting to take their chairs. And this other guy comes in, and he looks at me, and I looked at him. This old hippie leans against the wall on the other side of the double doors. And we're both, I thought, you know what? We're the cool section here. All these lames are sitting down, you know, and hugging and laughing. Me and this other cool guy over here with the cool section in this meeting. And we were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We're like, hey, dude. And people would say, there's some chairs up here. If you want to sit down, there's some empty chairs. Yeah, I see them. I'm a little bit drunk, but I'm not blind. I see people come in. They put down keys, put down a jacket, put down a purse. No purse, no keys, no jacket. That seat is available. I get it. I'm a figure outer. But I may not be able to stay for your whole deal, see? So I'll be okay standing back here. I don't want to have to get up, pardon me, excuse me, all that. And I think today, if somebody said to me, no, I'll stand back here. I don't know if I'll be able to stay for your whole meeting. I figure he's going to get a call or a text or something. I'm talking about 1986. Nobody had cell phones in those days. I mean, they had mobile phones, but they were big. They were in briefcases, and they were very expensive. Surgeons had them. Producers had them. I didn't have one. I didn't even have a pager. But I didn't have a pager, but you know what I had? I had a garage door opener with a belt clip on it. I got it at Goodwill for 75 cents, and I would wear it around so I'd look important, and it never, ever bothers you. But if you're in the middle of a conversation and you want to go get a drunk on, you go, oh, I got to get this. I'll be right back. And it worked like a charm, unless somebody said, what is that? Looks like my garage door opener. And then you got to think fast. Yeah, it is. Well, yeah, it is. It's a combination. Garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. The latest, coolest thing. I got one. And so me and this other cool guy are standing back at the back of the room. And everybody else is sitting down. They start the meeting. And they get the meeting going. And the first thing that happened got my attention. The secretary says, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And I thought, well, that's cool. I didn't know they celebrated people's birthdays. So I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny auntie, right? There's one person standing up and walking towards the stage, and she's 50 if she's a day. First thing I thought, my God, if she's 18, she should stop drinking tonight. And then I realized, yeah, no, because she doesn't look bad. She didn't look, she looked great for 50, just a little whipped for a teenager. But she's all dressed up and made up and coiffed, you know. So, okay, this is Ruth. This is AA. AA, they don't drink. I bet you Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. And I don't know if you call them birthdays or anniversaries back in Virginia, but we call them birthdays. And we have cakes and candles, and we sing. You know, it's Hollywood, man. The business is here. So we give them the business. So when I thought, okay, Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. Happy birthday, Ruth. Oh, my God, I cued the choir. 200 people start singing, happy birthday, in four different keys at the same time. And many of them were not even committed to the key they started in. And I told you, I'm a musician. This did not go unnoticed by me. I thought, damn, you know, is everybody tone deaf? And I thought, somebody in this room can fake happy birthday on the piano. They had a piano on stage. And I thought, any group of 200 Americans, somebody can fake happy birthday on the piano. I'm a guitar player, and I could do it on the piano. I thought, maybe I should, you know, run up there. Here I come to save the day, you know, get everybody in the same key. And then I said, no. How often does that hero thing work out for you, Doug? Why don't you just shut up? It's a short song. Okay. And then Ruth steps up and Ruth says, my name is Ruth and I'm an alcoholic. And of course, everybody says, hi, Ruth. Oh my God. This is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And I first heard that line from Scott Redmond. Yes, that's it. That's what we found here. And so then Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. I didn't know they had meetings every day. And I didn't know anybody would want to go to a meeting every day, let alone for 18 years. So I thought, you're a little slow, aren't you, Ruth? You are just not the sharpest knife in the drawer, sweetie. Because I don't know if I want this thing. But if I do, it's not going to take me every day for 18 years. I know that for sure. Because I'm a quick study. I'm a hum a few bars and I'll fake it kind of guy. So I looked over at the other cool guy to see if he's giggling at Ruth. Now, he's not as cool as I thought he was because he was singing with him. There's a strong possibility I'm the only cool one in the room. But now I know he's not cool. He's a member. I don't know why he's standing at the back. Maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something. But now he's heading over to me, and he's got his hand out like we do, you know, and that sunbeam for Jesus smile. Like, and he takes my hand in both hands, and he says, I tell you what, man, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. I was shocked. Because, for one thing, I don't know anything about this man. The only thing I really know about him is he values cake more than I do. And because it seemed to me, if you don't drink for a year, they ought to give you a car. You know what I mean? You know, some kind of a prize beside the cake. And so I was so shocked I couldn't even make fun of him. I said, I'm not much of a pastry eater, pal. You know, if I wanted a cake, I'd just, you know, stop at Piggly Wiggly on the way home. That's not even out of my way. I got to stop and get a six pack anyway, but thank you. And then somebody spoke. So it was a speaker. It was a speaker meeting. And what I love this. I don't remember if the speaker was a man or a woman or what he or she said. And most of the meeting was a speaker talking about him or herself. And that tickles me because Carla and I do a lot of this speaking. And sometimes if you go places, you know, they buy you an airplane ticket and they pick you up and they take you to the meals. And they sometimes there's a fruit basket in your hotel room. I want to say to them, I don't know if you got the right guy. All I ever did was ruin my life and hurt everybody that ever cared about me, you know. Yeah, tell us about that. So anyway, the speaker wasn't important to me, the newcomer that night. What was important was Ruth took a cake. Hank talked to me. They had three different kinds of coffee. And the secretary said, this is our big book. This is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the basic text of our program, the only authority on AA. If you're new here tonight, please don't leave without this book. So I thought, very well, I will steal that book. They had a bunch of them on a table with some other literature, and I figured I could go pick up that book, act like I'm fascinated. Let's see how it works. Oh, this is how it works. This is great. This is really going to help me. And walk right out the door. And I had a feeling if they even noticed, they'd say, let him go. And I still think that might have happened. But I have my plan to commit this minimal crime, this petty crime. And the secretary screwed it up before I could even take a step towards the literature table. She said, if you're new tonight, and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have this book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. And that sounds loving and generous, of course, unless you're going to steal the book. And now if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm homeless, you know, and I mean, I have my pride. I will steal from it, but I won't accept your goddamn charity. So now I have to buy the book. And she didn't say how much it was. She said we sell it at our cost. Okay. Yeah. It's a hardcover book. It's probably 20, maybe 25 bucks. I don't really care how much it is. I'm buying this book tonight. If I got to write a bad check, I'm buying the book. So, after the meeting, I go up to her and I said, excuse me, ma'am, can I buy one of your books? She said, oh, the big book? Yeah. Yeah. The big book. Yeah. I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? It's $4.65 for a hardcover book. I think I can handle that. Yeah. Here's a five. Keep the change. And she said, no, I'll get your change. No, lady, listen to me. I want you to keep that change and use the change to help a drunk because I'm on my feet. Okay. So now I got my big book, and on the way home, I stopped and bought a bottle of whiskey. So I got home and I sat down with this big book and I poured three fingers of whiskey and I started to read this book. Please don't anybody imagine that I stayed up all night studying the big book. That didn't happen. I don't have to do, for one thing, I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and pretty much know everything in the chapter. It's a gift that I have. And so, doctor's opinion, I've had doctor's opinion. Bill's story, who cares? Chapter two, there's a solution. That's a sales pitch. There's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. Great. Chapter three, more about alcoholism. Ooh, that sounds like it actually could be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. So I'm already up to chapter four, which you may know is titled We Agnostics. And what I read was How the Smart People Get Sober Without God. Because when I walked into my first AA meeting, I expected to find a bunch of people who used to drink like me. They don't drink anymore. I knew that about AA. And they were primarily atheists and agnostics. Nobody ever said that to me. But my grandmother, who was a drunk, who found Jesus when I was about 6 years old, and just picked up the cross and ran with it, man. She just, it changed her life. She became an ordained minister in the Pentecostal church. She opened a Skid Row mission on Beacon Street in San Pedro. If you know that area, it's a tough Port of Los Angeles wharf area. And my grandmother's Pentecostal mission, the White Dove Mission, was down there for 37 years. And she spent her last 37 years doing what we do. Trust God, clean house, help others. And my grandmother hated AA. And I always thought it was because there was no God here. And I wish I had had a chance to really talk to her about it. But I'll tell you this. Before she died, she said, Doug, I know you're doing God's work. I was about 3 years sober then. So I always thought that AA had no God. So when I walked in here and everybody's talking about my higher power, power greater than yourself, humbly asked him with a capital H, admitted to God, prayed to God, told God, oh my God, God, the last house on the block is Sunday school and I'm pissed. But now I got this book, the only authority on AA, the secretary had said, a whole chapter called We Agnostics. I poured another three fingers of whiskey and I read this chapter looking for how the smart people stay sober without God. And it's not in there. Everything in that chapter is just the opposite. In fact, I must have missed something. Like, for instance, the very first paragraph that says, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop drinking entirely, or once you start, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. And if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. First paragraph. But I'm like, yeah, where's the smart people? So I read the whole chapter, and I didn't get anything out of it. So I poured some more whiskey, and I read it again. And the second time I read it, some of the black part, the print, jumped off the page at me, especially one sentence. It says, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Not we suggest, or maybe it looks like, or it appears to us, We found, this was our finding, this is the, we have evidence that God does not make too hard terms on those who seek him. And I thought I was fairly educated in religions of the world. Not any kind of an expert, certainly, but Eastern and Western religions. I thought I knew something about them. And really all I had was my drunken opinion of organized religion. But I'll tell you, I knew my grandmother's Pentecostal church never said, we don't think God makes hard terms. If anything, they said the opposite. They said, you know, Doug, they call me Doug, you know, Doug, we are very sure that God makes hard terms on those who seek him. Boy, you know, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. I'm talking about total submission. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here, boy. Come on up. Come on up, son. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Oh, man, somebody get that boy a towel. I'm like, well, I'm 14 years old, and I thought, I am not getting wet in this room tonight. I don't know what they know. I don't know if my grandmother told them I touched myself or what. But I could imagine Brother Van Dyke saying the next day, I tell you what, I'm going to miss that boy's guitar playing, but thank God he don't have to abuse himself no more. So I told him, I got, you know what, I got brand new Levi's on, shrink to fit. You know what I'm saying? Like if I get in there, I wouldn't be able to ride my bicycle home. So I'm not getting wet in this room tonight. See you later. And I'm out the door. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals. My girlfriend was a Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons to determine how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers would cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. Because you know what? Catholics don't have sin. They got levels of it. Venial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them, you don't have to do them. If you think about them, express way to hell, partner. Like, oh my God, burning perdition for eternity for thinking about sin. I don't think that's going to be my deal, you know. I wonder how long I could go without thinking, oh shit. And so anyway, like my friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and he and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school. I thought, there is a loving God for you. Thou shalt wear spit curls to public school. I don't know. Maybe they're trying to make a fighter out of him in case the Nazis come back. But I never figured out why they had to do that. I went over to Michael's house for dinner one night. His mom says, Doug, would you like to join us in some wine and challah? And I said, some what? She said, would you like to join the family in some wine and challah? And I said, well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, Mrs. Stein. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. So the guy that came to AA in 1986 was like, here's the line, all the religions over the world, I'll be over here making fun of you. But that guy is reading this book the secretary had said was the only authority. And it says, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms. And that's preceded by a sentence that says, you don't have to accept anybody's concept of God. The deal is, evidently, find a concept of God that you're comfortable with, and the Creator is comfortable with that. That's not something I ever heard any place in my life, but it got my attention. It made it easy to go back to AA, so I started going regularly, 5, 6, 7 times a week. And at that time in Los Angeles, there was about 2,000 meetings a week. And now I guess there's about 3,000. But 2,000 meetings a week, you know, in a 30-mile radius, I could go to a different meeting every day. And people wouldn't get to know me, but I'd get to know AA. And that was my intention. So I would start going to meetings, and I was one meeting I was going to, the San Fernando group, I liked that because it seemed like it was primarily cowboys and scooter trash and housewives. And I've always liked cowboys and scooter trash and housewives. So I started going there pretty regularly. And I was going there, and anybody that needed new people in the first 30 days, Doug, alcoholic, Do we have anybody with less than 30 days of sobriety? Doug, alcoholic. I did this for a couple of months, and finally I just got tired of it. I just, you know, I thought, I'm not raising my damn hand in here. I'm like, none of their business, you know. People are getting sober around me, and I, by the way, my first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. So that's the guy that was going to San Fernando, raising his hand as a newcomer, and finally I decided I'm not going to do that anymore. None of their business. So I didn't raise my hand, and this girl at the end of the table, girl Crystal, she says to her friend, Doug's got 30 days. And I don't know how she knew my name, Doug Alcoholic, but I didn't want to disappoint her. She was on my 13-step list, which I should make clear was not a conquest list. It was a wish list, because I couldn't have got lucky in a women's prison with a pocket full of pardons, but I wasn't somebody you'd want the neighbor's dog to see you with, you know. But I had a list just in case. And so Crystal said, Doug's got 30 days. So I took a 30-day chip over at San Fernando. Everybody was thrilled about it. Yay, Doug. Oh, it's nothing, because there was nothing. But then I started going around taking chips. And I had a 60-day chip here and a 30-day chip there and a six-month chip there. And I had four different sobriety dates and four different groups. I'm not recommending that. The only reason I mention it is because in case somebody's doing that, keep coming back. It's the only thing I did right in 8 months. But one night I came home from a meeting and with a bottle of whiskey, and I laid on the floor and turned on the TV, and I just drank whiskey till I passed out. I woke up about 3 a.m., and that was almost every night. Woke up about 3 a.m., turned off the TV, got my bottle, crawled on my hands and knees through the living room into the bedroom to go to bed, stood up to get undressed, and fell. I fell on my knees and spilled this whiskey all over the bed, and I picked up the bottle, and there was some left, but most of it was in the bedspreads. So I'm down on my knees, sucking whiskey out of a bedspread, and a voice in my head said, "Amen. That ain't right." I'm like, you thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle, man. I'm not thirsty. I'm frugal. I'll waste my life, but I'm not letting the whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. And I looked at what I was doing. Yeah, there was whiskey in the bottle. I'm done drinking. I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. And I was out of ideas, and I was lost and alone. And just, I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I absolutely meant it, and I absolutely did not believe anybody could hear that prayer. I'm not even sure I knew it was a prayer. But I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I went to bed, and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, every day or nearly every day, I go in my neighborhood liquor store. There's somebody from AA behind the counter. I'm in the Vaughn's Market in the liquor department. Reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. And, I'm at a restaurant, start to order a margarita. The waitress is somebody from AA. After 2 weeks of this, I'm on the way to work at 6:30. I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. I rolled down the window. A guy from AA is driving towards me at 6:30 a.m., and he waved at me, and I threw a bottle in front of his car. Bing, da-ling, bang, in. I thought, where are these people coming from? Like those damn miracles people talk about in the meetings. And the moment I had the thought of miracles, it was like I could hear God laughing. And I remembered I had been on my knees and said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I pulled the car over to the side of the road. And all of these little daily coincidences, Bill Wilson called them trains of circumstances, went by me, miracles. And I thought, I asked for help, and I got help. And I realized what happened. I went back to the San Fernando that group that night after work, and I told them what I just told you, what happened. I said, I've been lying to you for 8 months. And yesterday, this morning, I had a Bill Wilson major white light experience. And I don't drink anymore. And they're like, yay, Doug. Okay, next. And this guy, Sage, comes up to me afterwards and he says, hey, congratulations, Doug. That's good. I'm glad you got that. I hope that keeps you sober. I said, well, I'm pretty sure it will, Sage. You know, I had the major Bill Wilson white light experience. So, you know, I think I'm good now. He goes, yeah, I heard you. I hope that works, man. And I said, Sage, I'm sorry about you and your educational variety, man, but I had the major Bill Wilson white light spiritual awakening. And he said, oh my God. Oh my God. You came around here lying to us for 8 months and you finally tried what you heard us say we did and it worked for you. And now you think you're Bill Wilson. That white light you saw with your head coming out of your ass. They tell you stuff here, you know. They make things clear. And so I came to believe, and my life has been so good. I just have such a blessed life. I've been happily and faithfully married for 23 years to three of the finest women that ever walked through the doors of AA. And and the last one, the final one, is sitting here with us tonight. And the best one, and I say she's the best one. Man, she had strong competition. She's just the best person I ever knew. And we're great friends. Yesterday was our 11th anniversary of the first time we had breakfast together in Scottsdale, Arizona, when we were both speaking at a conference. And we've been having breakfast ever since. My daughter, who I disappointed time and time and time and time again, told me a couple of years ago when I was 30 years sober, I always thought of you as the fun parent. Now I realize you're the one who was always there for me. And I wasn't always there for her. First 15 years of her life, she didn't know if I was going to show up or disappoint her. She didn't know if I was going to be the fun, funny guy or the drunken bum. But the 30 years after that, I was always there for her. And it looked like I was the guy who was always there for her. And my dad, when he was on his deathbed, I said to him, Daddy, everything good about me I got from you. And he said, it's not true. I said, it is true, Dad. You're the one who taught me how to be a son, how to be a father, how to be a brother, how to be a husband, how to be a neighbor, how to be an employee, everything I got from you. And he said, well, you have AA. And he was right. Everything he tried to teach me, and that I've actually learned, I couldn't put into practice until I came to you, a drunken bum, and you had me take those 12 steps. And it gave me a sense of self and a sense of community and a sense of integrity and faith, and became the man my father tried to raise me to be. And my friend Teddy, man, she married this handsome TV star and they had a little girl. And he continued in his TV career, and she started working in treatment. And Teddy helped hundreds of people to get sober. And when she was 27 years sober, she had some back surgery, and she had to take some pain medication. And she just let it get out of hand. She started over, you know, intaking, and she started going to multiple doctors. Then she started getting it on the street. And finally, she had to go to her sponsor and tell her she was out of control. And her sponsor said, okay, we're going to get you straightened out, Ted, but you got to start your time over. Teddy told me later, I thought, if I got to start my time over, I'm getting a bottle of Jack and doing it right. And she did that. And over the next 7 years, she could not get 60 days sober. She tried and tried and came, and we all tried to help her. Everybody she knew tried to help her. And she started reverting back to being this crazy woman. You know, and she lied to everybody. And finally, a friend of mine called me and told me she passed. And the next day, her daughter called me and said, Doug, my dad says you're a singer. I wonder if you'd sing at Mom's funeral. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I sang at Teddy's funeral, a song that I wrote that she always liked. And I changed some of the lyrics to fit her. And I asked her husband, do you think it was suicide? And he said, I don't think it was deliberate, Doug. She didn't leave a note, but I don't think she cared if she lived or died. And that's what's on the table for me now. Forget about brain death. That's what's on the table for me. I have the most blessed life of anybody I know, and I could go to where I don't care if I live or die. Just to have my daughter love me, my wife love me, and have my father's respect, I'm overpaid. Thanks for letting me share.